Senate Finance will come to order. Thanks to Senator Bundy, Dyson, Stedman, Co-Chair Wilken, and Senator Olson. We've got three pieces of legislation today that we'll be hearing, and two of them have to do with the Department of Transportation and one with the railroad. And we'll take up Senate Bill 261 for Senator Wilken. Do you have any announcements?
No, ma'am. Thank you for asking.
Okay. John McKinnon, are you going to be presenting today on 261?
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Transportation for Highways and Facilities. The first bill we have up today, Senate Bill 261, has to do with the ability of the department to establish traffic safety corridors, and in the act of doing that, or as part of that, double the traffic fines on those corridors. And this came about as a result of another in a series of tragic accidents on the Seward Highway beginning of January. We looked at what we could do immediately to start it, to address these things. The conventional wisdom is when you start having a lot of accidents on a road, you do some structural improvements to the road. You change the geometry, you widen it, add passing lanes and that. But we're looking for something that would produce some more immediate results. And in researching what other states do, there are about a half a dozen other states that have the ability to establish traffic safety corridors in areas where they have a higher than average rate of fatal and very serious accidents. It's been used very successfully in other parts of the country, and we felt that it would be a good thing to do here. And in the course of doing that, we analyzed a number of highway segments, mostly in the central region of the state. We haven't gotten into the northern region yet. And in looking at those, it was quite surprising some of the accidents, or some of the road segments we had that and the accident rates on those. We had assumed that the Seward Highway was, quote, the most dangerous stretch of highway in the state. But after the analysis, it showed that a couple of stretches of road in your backyard, Madam Chairman, were every bit, if not more, dangerous as the Seward Highway. And when it comes to fixing some of these issues, the problems we have with the highways, like I said, the conventional wisdom is to widen it, to add passing lanes and that, but the more immediate results are in dealing with driver behavior. And a lot of research has shown that it's the high-risk drivers, the drivers that aren't driving safely, that they respond to only one message, and that message is increased enforcement. And added to that message with increased enforcement, what we're proposing is double traffic fines in those areas. The passage of a safety corridor law gives the commissioner, in consultation with the commissioner of transportation, in consultation with the commissioner of public safety, to designate corridors of roads as traffic safety corridors. Along with that designation, like I said, will come increased enforcement. The increased enforcement in those areas will be paid for by the Department of Transportation using safety sanction funds. The safety sanction funds are funds that are pulled out of our normal federal highway aid dollars, and we're required to use those for safety items and issues associated with the roads. Some improvements on the geometry side of things, and some educational campaigns such as Click It or Ticket on increased DUI enforcement. Part of this bill allows the increased fines as a result of the double traffic fines to be returned to the department, which will again be returned to the Department of Public Safety to pay for that increased enforcement. Now, with me today I have Cindy Cashin, who is the State Highway Safety Officer, Kurt Smith, who's a state highway traffic engineer, as well as Lieutenant James Helgo from the Department of Public Safety. And we have worked with the Department of Public Safety in crafting this bill and coming up with something that we both agree can be an effective measure in reducing deaths and serious accidents on the highways.
Are any of the people that you just mentioned interested in testifying today? Are they just here to answer questions?
I believe they're just here to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Now, in your packet are a couple of maps, actually four maps, that really illustrate the point we're trying to make. On those maps, and let's just pick, hopefully it's the first one on your list, which is the Seward Highway from Potter Marsh to Girdwood. It shows the fatal accident locations during the time period 1977 to 2005. And in that stretch of highway, there are a tremendous number of fatal accidents. And as you read the little boxes that are associated with each fatal accident, you can read that many of those are many of them are driver behavior issues. The blue boxes obviously are, because they're the ones that where alcohol and drugs are involved. But a lot of the white ones, the yellow ones, are because of inattention, unsafe speed, improper lane change. Again, another improper lane change. Driver behavior issues, and it's the increased enforcement that has the biggest effect on controlling driver behavior.
Interesting statistics. Just the blue and yellow boxes. Okay, are there any questions for Mr. McKinnon? Senator Stedman.
Yes, Madam Chair, could we get a little explanation on, I understand, the escalation in fines, like a little testimony on points that drivers get, if there's, increased points against their license, and if there's any increased penalties if there's alcohol and or drug use.
Okay.
In this area, when they start escalating penalties.
Okay.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, this bill would just deal with increased fine penalties. I don't believe it doubles the points in those traffic safety corridors.
Because the penalty itself is still excess speed, and so.
Correct. It hits them in the pocketbook.
So, therefore, then it would not be a point issue. But, go ahead.
If I could, Madam Chair, I'm just kind of curious on why, if we want to modify behavior and doubling the fines or any escalation above the normal fines, gets people's attention. But it seems to me like if we were to have a multiple of points added, it's certainly going to get people's attention a lot more. But so I'm just kind of curious if there's been a discussion along those lines, or some reason why that is not applicable to, or if they feel it's just too severe of a reaction or penalty.
Because I know that when we had the discussion on in construction zones, that particular issue I don't recall coming up. It was just the double fine. Cindy, did you have something to add? If you could introduce yourself, please.
My name's Cindy Cash, and I'm the administrator for the Alaska Highway Safety Office in the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. Senator Stedman, your question is a good one. And, of course, the person who would answer that would be Dwayne Bannock with DMV. But I can tell you that when there's excessive speeding, there's a separate charge called racing, and they lose points through that. When you're looking at high-risk drivers, the majority of high-risk drivers tend to have already lost their license. That's not effective in making them change their behavior. What's effective with them is hitting them in the pocketbook.
It's what? It's getting them what? Off the road?
Hitting them in the pocketbook.
Oh, hitting them in the pocketbook.
The wallet.
The wallet.
The purse.
Okay. Any other questions? Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the bill itself, had a question about page 1, line 13. Under to John, if the word may there shouldn't be, this speaks about the Commissioner of Public Safety and may consult with local, state, and federal agencies responsible for public safety. Should that not perhaps be shall consult so that we make sure that the commissioner is doing something that the local and state officials know he's doing or she's doing?
Through the chair, Senator Wilken, I believe that language is that way. These traffic safety corridors will primarily be rural, and by saying rural, I mean not in urban areas. Urban area traffic accidents are usually a result of intersection issues and not long stretches of road. We definitely want to be required. We want it mandatory for consultation with public safety, but there may not be a local entity to consult with. We will consult with any local entity there is, state, local, or federal.
Would you object to having the word may replaced with the word shall?
I would have no objection to that, Senator Wilken.
Madam Chair, I would move that page 1, line 13, the word may be replaced with the word shall.
I'm going to object for discussion. Are these primarily on state and federal highways?
Madam Chair, yes, they are.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm getting on my league when I get into bill drafting, but if it says shall consult with other, does that mean they're going to have to talk to everybody in the state before they move forward, or would it be other local, state, and federal responsible for traffic safety in that area?
Because in order to get this drafted,
shall consult with involved.
They've simply used statistics and said these are the primary trouble spots, and they haven't consulted with downtown Wasilla or Mat-Su or City of Anchorage, Borough of Anchorage, to these in place. And it'd be like changing the speed limit. You don't consult with local entities if you're going to change the speed limit on a state highway, do you? You don't do that. Do you do that?
Madam Chairman, yes, the department does change speed limits.
I was thinking public safety.
And we're not required to, I believe, but as a matter of courtesy, we do.
Okay. Senator Wilken.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess speaking to the motion, consult is a pretty loose word, and at the very least, I would think that the state should make these folks, in regard to the traffic safety corridor, at least aware of what they're trying to do, and that's probably the minimum level of consultation. It doesn't speak to being approved or passed by any sort of assembly or anything. It's just they'll let them know, and I think that's important to have local folks know that they're going to change their traffic. I want to say restrictions, but I guess it is a restriction.
And Madam Chairman, I would assume the intent is we shall consult with other local, state, and federal agencies with responsibility for traffic safety in that area. Mm-hmm. I'd hate to get into a bind where, in dealing with a Seward Highway issue, an attorney at some point in the future would say you didn't talk to the Fairbanks Police Department about this.
No, that sentence speaks to a traffic safety corridor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So. Yes, Mr. Helgo.
For the record, I'm Lieutenant James Helgo with the Alaska State Troopers. Right now, we do share information with all municipal and local law enforcement agencies. For statistical gathering, for grant statistics that come through highway safety. So we do share that information. We do have good working relationships with the Wasilla Police Department, Palmer Police Department, and all police departments in the state. So I just want to assure the committee that we would share that information and we would work together with sharing those statistics.
Okay. I'll withdraw my objection. Is there further comment on Amendment Number 1? Amendment Number 1 is adopted. Is there further questions? Oh, Senator Wilken.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In our packets, we have something called draft. John, could you explain what this is?
Through the chair, Senator Wilken, this is a draft additions to our traffic or highway traffic manual. And the traffic manual is the document that we use that controls when and where signs should be used and how they should be placed in that. And this is what we're proposing to use as far as our regulations for establishing and disestablishing traffic safety corridors. The thought of putting it into the traffic manual is that it can be adjusted quickly if we find that for some reason the target we picked was not correct. If we put it into regulation, it's a much more time-consuming process to change it, and obviously even more so in statute. The traffic manual is what governs where we put signs, how we put them, why we put them, as well as the kind of signs that are put out there.
So if this bill is passed, this would be inserted into the traffic manual?
That's correct. And what it says, that in order to establish a traffic safety corridor, we have to have a three-year record looking back 3 years and show that the fatal plus major injury accident rate per mile exceeds 110% of the statewide average. There are some thresholds that have to be reached. And also after 3 years of having a traffic safety corridor in place where we have some statistics of hopefully a drop in the accident rate, we can see that there has been a significant improvement, and we can disestablish or decommission a traffic safety corridor. And we plan that when we do establish a traffic safety corridor, that it be done with a certain amount of publicity and information out there to the public. Okay. As well as when one is decommissioned, I think we want to trumpet our success.
Senator Bundy.
Thank you. I'm certainly in agreement with what you're trying to achieve. The unfortunate thing here is we're going to have to kill some people before we get to do this. Is there a potential for local government, local group in Alaska to say this is a particularly dangerous section of road we know because we live here and there haven't been any fatalities, but there have been near misses and whatever, to appeal to the department to consider implementing a safety zone before the fatalities occur?
Senator Bundy, through the chair, there is always the potential to do that, but to try and get one designated with no statistics, just betting that it's going to be a dangerous stretch of road, I guess my concern there would be that we as a result of that mechanism, end up creating too many safety corridors, and when you have too many of them out there, they lose a certain amount of their effectiveness. And you're right, it is, it's bad, it's a sad thing that we have to kill people before we can establish one of these.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
Kind of on a similar topic, Madam Chair. In areas where they don't have high traffic volume due to lower populations and shorter roads, maybe we can get a little bit of an explanation of the interaction between the department and the communities when the community wants to take a proactive approach rather than wait until there's fatalities to push the speed limit down. My understanding is if the communities request that, the DOT is fairly responsive. Is that not correct, or is that?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think it's fairly correct statement that we are responsive when you get enough people that are concerned about the speed limit on a particular road. We do make adjustments to those. Along the same lines, there are always people who would like the speed limit increased on a number of roads, and there's a lot more resistance to increasing speed limits. On some stretches of road, however, to reduce the speed limit does not necessarily result in a decrease in accidents, because it's the speeders that are causing a lot of these problems and not the people obeying the speed limit. We're not going to post a high speed limit on a road when the geometry of the road isn't capable of handling that speed limit. So the goal here is to direct this effort towards driver behavior, to those drivers that are the high-risk drivers.
It sounds like on page one, though, lines 9 through 12, you could, if you wanted to, because it says, establish the commissioner may consider accident data reports, the type and volume of vehicle traffic, engineering traffic studies, and other relevant factors. And if people came to you with information that you could validate, you know, that, because I think you do have to have the statistical, it would be only wise to have the statistical data, but you could certainly take your lead from Senator Bundy's, you know, request or Senator Stedman's that there's something needs to be done here.
Madam Chairman, that is correct, and I believe that's why that's there. There are always the non-technical reasons for establishing one of these, and that allows us to do that. But again, our concern would be, in the draft regulations, we're proposing that no more than 10 are established safe statewide. I don't anticipate that there would be more than 10. Again, they lose some of their effectiveness in quantity. And it's also the question of whether the troopers or the local PDs would be able to adequately increase enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a major piece of it, too.
Yeah.
He's there to watch. Are there other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. McKinnon, as we look at behavioral modification, one of the questions that I have is that if you have deaths on the highway, those people are dead and they can't really be, behavior can't be modified. And so I've seen it somewhat counterintuitive to come up with this, with these type of restrictions or doubling the fines to have that be in any way effective.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Olson, the sad part of that is quite often in many of these dots on the maps, the fatalities aren't the driver that was driving excessively. Quite often the fatality is the innocent person that gets hit head on by the person that's passing in the wrong zone.
And Madam Chairman, one last question is that how often when you have these doubling of the fines, how often do you collect from these people that are obviously got a mind that is not going to be held within parameters or held to judgments and things like that. What's the collection rate for these that have had the double fines levied against them?
Yeah, Senator Olson, through the chair, I don't have an answer for that one, but I can certainly try and find out.
I'd like to know if it's effective or not. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
Yes, on the fiscal note, the last fiscal note, showing a cost of $5,000, I think that's per corridor, and if we're looking at 7 to 10 corridors, we may just want to adjust that number up to, if it's 7, $35,000, and even though, Madam Chair, sometimes we work in billions and millions, it's still money.
Any response on that? It should be 20,000 versus 5,000?
Or 30, probably 30. If they do, if it's 5,000 a corridor, and they do seven corridors, that should be about 35,000. So it's, I think it's, the way I read it, it's 5,000 per corridor.
Madam Chairman, that is correct, and that's the cost of, there will be a significant amount of signage posted in each corridor. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we wouldn't be doing our job adequately if the drivers through there weren't informed that they're in a traffic safety corridor and that there are double traffic fines. So at the beginning and the end, it'll say entering traffic safety corridor, next X miles, end traffic safety corridor, and throughout the corridor there will be additional signs, and this is our estimate of what it would cost per corridor to put those signs up.
Well, do you think in certain areas of the Mat-Su you could also put some Todd signs advertising business locations just right underneath that traffic corridor sign?
Is that a motion?
Yeah.
Like an undertaker's advertisement?
No. Are there other questions? Senator Wilson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. John, this is really interesting information. Could I just respectfully suggest that you put on each of these just a little box that tells what the blue and the yellow mean? I mean, after you study it for a while, you see what it means. Blue is alcohol and drugs, and yellow is not. But that would be interesting just because it is quite startling.
No, actually, every one of those boxes, Senator Olson, is fatal. The blue ones indicate that there was some substance use and abuse involved in it. The yellow ones are other issues. But the blue ones are definitely drug or alcohol-related fatalities or major accidents. And Senator Wilkin, yeah, we should probably add that to the key. Department of Public Safety, when we first showed these to them on, I believe, the 24th of February, they were very interested in getting them and distributing them to their troopers in the various stations, because if you look at the one Connect Goose Bay Road, you see little grape clusters there of accidents, and that would help them determine where they need to focus a little bit more of their enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very interesting.
And another interesting note there, the red dots indicate major accidents or fatalities after a significant highway improvement. The white ones are before the highway improvement, and that is a clear indication that it is a driver behavior issue.
That is really interesting on the Connect Goose Bay, but went from one to multiple. On the signage by construction sites, you know, double fine. Has there been any noticeable difference that we could report or hear about since the implementation of that? Or are you able to gather statistics on that? Or has that been successful?
Madam Chair, I'll have to turn around and see if anyone else knows that.
Welcome.
Thank you. Kurt Smith, State Traffic and Safety Engineer, DOTPF. We don't have any data. Data is hard to collect in construction zones. We've had opinions from the people that work on our construction projects, and they feel that they generally are effective.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I would hope so. I certainly would. It scares me to pieces when I see that sign. It reminds me to slow down. So, are there any other questions? Any other information? For the committee, Dwayne Bannock has joined us online and is certainly available for questions. Dwayne, did you have anything else you wanted to offer on this particular piece of legislation, 261?
Good morning, Senator. No, ma'am. I was just here to answer any questions if there were any for us.
Okay. And thank you, Dwayne, for joining us. Looks like there are no questions. Are there any other information anyone needs about this? I don't object to moving this out today and getting it on its way to create traffic corridors. Senator Bundy.
If I may, having the Seward Highway in my district, make the motion to move this bill from committee with individual recommendations, attach fiscal notes, and the hopes that there will be fewer dead Alaskans on the highway.
Thank you. Are there objections? Being none. Senate Bill 261 is moved from committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal notes. Probably should ask. Next is Senate Bill 271. Authorizing the Commissioner of Transportation and Public Facilities to participate in certain federal highway programs and related to that authorization. Are you doing this, Mr. John?
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, John McKinnon, Deputy Commissioner of Transportation for Highways and Facilities, and thank you for scheduling these back-to-back. As an introduction to this, Safety Lou, the reauthorization of the highway bill, which passed last summer and was signed into effect in August 10th, includes a NEPA delegation pilot program for five states, Alaska, California, Oklahoma, Ohio, and Texas. And under this program, all five states are eligible to apply for delegation from the Secretary of Transportation the NEPA responsibilities for one or more highway projects or programs. The state may also apply for delegation of some or all of the Secretary's review and consultation responsibilities under other federal environmental laws. But the scope of this particular delegation in the pilot program will be determined through an application to the Secretary of Transportation and an execution of a memorandum of understanding. The pilot program will last 6 years through the time of reauthorization of this bill. It will not, at this point, let me back up a little bit. The Secretary of Transportation is required to write up some rules and regulations establishing this delegation, and it's required to be done within 270 days of the passage of the signing of the bill. They are behind a little bit, as we've been told, but once that rulemaking is done, then the state may submit an application to assume these NEPA responsibilities. And we must also advertise and solicit public comment on that. And once that is done, the state and the Secretary of Transportation will enter into that MOU, and once the MOU is executed, then the state may proceed. What this does is it takes the decision-making process on what level of environmental documentation is required out of the hands of the Federal Highway Administration and puts it in the hands of the State Department of Transportation. What it does is puts us in a little more control of the process and the rate at which these environmental reviews proceed. It does not result in any less environmental protection, any less environmental review. We're still required to follow the National Environmental Protection Act, federal rules, but it puts us in control at the pace at which it proceeds. I want to note that it is limited to highway projects only. It's not. It doesn't relate to airport aviation projects or other federal projects within the state. It's just those that would be administered by the Federal Highway Administration. It's limited, and then it's also limited to environmental decision making, not engineering issues.
Senator Bundy.
It puts us in control. We have to abide by the federal standards so we can make them more restrictive, but not less restrictive.
Through the chair, Senator Bundy, we will follow the federal laws on this. We're required to at that level. We will not be establishing our own state environmental policy protection act.
Well, I guess I'm trying to understand what the advantage will be. So if we do this and then there is a suit, as there often is, the state would have to defend it.
That's correct.
And then that means this fiscal note is going to need to be adjusted. But what's the advantage to the state? We're going to follow the same rules. We just say we made the rules instead of the federal ones. Right, is that?
Is this not more
semantic?
To do with timing? Isn't the state in more of a position to better get these more timely than rely on the federal system?
Madam Chairman, that is correct. When these decisions are made at the federal level, there's nothing. There's not much governing the timing of the decisions. The pace of the decisions. It's not unusual for work to sit on a desk for a significant period of time. There's a much greater chance, an opportunity to move these documents along when they're sitting on one of our desks than when they're sitting on a federal desk. This also relates to the level of documentation required. Most of the environmental documentation are what are called categorical exclusions. When you repave a road, you still have to go through a NEPA process, believe it or not. You put in an overpass, it's a NEPA process. The simplest form of documentation is called a categorical exclusion, or a CADEX. We will be assuming that responsibility along with that, but where the federal government is involved is when they make the decision on what level of documentation is required. There are some projects that have historically been a Cat X, where at times the federal government will say, the feds will say, this needs to be an environmental assessment because we feel there are other issues involved here. There are times when an EA gets elevated to become an environmental impact statement or an EIS. What we're hoping is that with the passage of this and our assumption of NEPA delegation is that those decisions will be made at the state level and not at the federal level. And yes, there is with assuming this responsibility, there is the responsibility for defending those decisions in court. You have that on the first page. I think page 9 is the requirement to waive the state's immunity from suit in federal court. But the kind of lawsuits we're talking about, NEPA is a procedural law. And any decision in court on this would be that the department, for one reason or other, did not follow the correct procedure. And a court decision would be for the department to go back and do something over again, following the procedure correctly. The history with federal highways in defending these cases, judgments have been very small. And the cost of defending these for the vast majority of them have been very small. There are a couple of them in at the federal level that have drug on and have been fairly expensive. But in our analysis of this is the cost of defending these and assuming this program is an eligible cost and project cost. So it's not general fund that would be paying these costs. It would be the individual project.
Other comments or questions?
Yeah, I'm cautious about what we're gaining is worth the price. And I say that things move quickly, or a little more quicker at the state level. I'm guessing that's a relative term. Okay, thank you.
Senator Wilkin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, and people ask us why government grows. This is just a little tiny piece of why government grows. It's just inconceivable to me, personally, that we're going to spend 160 hours a week of doing what you just said we were going to do. It's not even in my realm. And how do I explain that to a constituent? I can't explain it. The feds just tell you to do it, and 5 years from now, we're going to sit here and just think the world's coming to an end because this program is going to go away. This is a mind-boggling piece of legislation to me, but some are. So, John, the question is, can we take the $647,000 and only hire two people?
Senator Wilkin, through the chair, the number of people that we feel we're going to need in order to administer this thing, it was based on the level what the Federal Highway Administration presently has it and what we feel we need to do. It's not a simple thing to assume. We've got to have firewalls in there so that we don't have the fox guarding the hen house.
Well, I just felt like I had to ask the question. So I don't feel much better, but
you
think I asked it and got the answer I expected, and I appreciate that. Thank you, John.
Is anybody's yours on the same subject?
You know, on the same subject, 160 hours a week, 37 and a half hours work week. I mean, we're talking four or five new people.
Four new people.
Thank you. Senator Stedman.
A little different viewpoint, kind of long, similar issues. If we're looking at, you know, three people or so, or however many they're going to hire, and we're looking at almost $650,000 a year, and we're certainly not paying these people by the road mile built. And I think if we looked into the statewide issues of how much planning we've done and how much road building we've done in the last 15 years, we'd find out that we've done a lot of planning and haven't built hardly anything. So if we go down this road, which I've got some issues with the sovereign position of the state, and I've got some issues of hiring these people without any parameters on production. I'm not interested in filling office towers up and having no road construction done. And until I start seeing some road construction in the state, I'm rather hesitant to expand this. I think the intent is good, but I am concerned that the cost that we have in planning per mile of road construction built would be alarming to this table if it ever hit us.
Are there other questions?
Just,
John McKinnon.
Madam Chairman, just a comment on that. You know, it's not our goal to take this over, this NEPA assumption over, and proceed at the same pace. The status quo isn't good enough for us. You know, we have as much frustration as you do and as the public does on the time it takes to develop a project. And one of those big factors in the time it takes to develop a project is called NEPA. You know, I think it would you'd be astounded if you knew what we have spent in both time and dollars on some of these environmental impact statements or even environmental assessments, which is a much lower level of documentation. It's not unusual to spend $8-15 million for an EIS for a major project and take years to do it. What this does is it puts the state in the decision-making position. Well, let me back up a little bit. One of the things that does drive the time and the expense of a project, of an EIS, is in dealing with the various resource agencies when they say, we need this information, we need that information, and we need this information in order to do a complete environmental assessment. We're not in the position right now to say, we don't think you need that information. The information that's there on this particular issue is adequate. It's more than adequate. It's the federal government that makes those decisions because they have the NEPA assumption. We're willing to assume the risk of making those decisions. We're a lot less adverse to risk than the federal government is on these issues. The likelihood of a serious mistake in carrying out one of these documents because you didn't gather sufficient information is the judge would say, well, you need to go back and count the caribou there one more time. We're willing to take that risk. And I think the benefits far outweigh the potential cost in that.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Forgive me if you already answered this question and I wasn't paying attention. What's the contractual services for? $154,000
per year. Senator Dyson, I'm not sure I know what that is for. And unless that is for what we are, I believe that might be what we would be paying the Department of Law. We will RSA to the Department of Law for a NEPA attorney expert.
Okay, so that might be a kind of an intergovernmental transfer as opposed to contracting with outside services?
That's correct.
Might be or is?
I believe it is. Okay. Every NEPA document, when it's getting ready to go out for final, has to go through a legal sufficiency review.
So, if I may continue, so we're not paying for another person in the Attorney General's office, we're contracting for somebody. I guess we're doing an intergovernmental transfer of the funding for somebody that's already there. Or, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Through this, Senator Dyson, we do have Jim Cantor, who's the department's attorney in the Department of Law, is very well versed in NEPA, but he does oversee a number of attorneys that deal with the department issues. This is going to be someone who has a fairly specific education and orientation towards NEPA.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Senator Stepin.
Yeah, if we could, Madam Chair, if we could just put aside the whole concept of cost of planning per road mile built, put that aside. I know you're looking at me funny, but if we actually looked at those numbers, it would be alarming. I'm kind of curious why there's just a select group of states, and Alaska's one of them, and you know where this was driven from, and do we as a state have a harder time than other states getting our projects through the NEPA process, and that's why this is coming forward, or you know, I guess I'd like
Congressman Young included Alaska among the group that was to be part of this pilot project, and I know in my work with Kubota, they spend a lot of time concerned with the NEPA process and the trips they've taken back to Washington to oversee it. And it's my opinion, this is unsubstantiated, it's my opinion though, that many of the projects that are very important to us are very small potatoes in Washington, D.C., as far as their importance on the NEPA interest level. And whereas they're big deals here, but they don't rise to the same level as many of the other huge projects in other states that have more going on. I may be wrong, you can confirm or deny.
Madam Chair, actually that's an accurate statement. And if you look at those states, a couple of those states have ranking members on the Transportation Committee, and they wanted to be there. And again, it is a pilot program. We have 5.5 years to run on this, and we're hoping for success. We don't want to lose it.
Senator Stedman?
If we go down this road, then can we have a report back at the end of 5 years for the expenditures versus road miles constructed?
Madam Chairman, Senator Stedman, we will come up with a metric that will hopefully show an improvement over the status quo.
Are there any other questions? I have no one else to testify. Do members have questions about this that they would like to discuss with John McKinnon or anyone from DOT? And Senator Bundy?
Yeah, I have serious reservations about, Senator Oakland's point out, growing government, 4 more new full-time state employees and the risk of lawsuits. I don't see the net gain, but...
Would you like to have more discussion about it?
No, I'd just like to vote no.
Okay. Is there anyone that will make the motion to move, that would move to send this on, or do you want to sit on it?
Madam Chair, move to report Senate Bill 271 for committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal notes.
And I'll object.
Do you want to speak to your objection?
I already have, I think.
Okay. Senator Stedman, you had your hand up. Would you like to speak?
Well, I was just going to say that it might be nice to hold this and get some more input.
Would you like to hold it?
Madam Chair, I move and ask unanimous consent that my motion be withdrawn.
Yeah, there being no objection, we will hold this and give members time to get more information and decide on the future of this piece of legislation. Thank you, John.
Thank you.
And turning to the railroad.
I just want to get in my no mode for the railroad. Oh, she didn't hear me.
Yes.
Madam Chair, could we get a window or two cracked open?
It is warm in here.
Thank you. Don't you just wish? Welcome, Dylan.
Madam Chair, members, thank you for hearing us this morning in support of Senate Bill 308, which is and for the record, my name is Pat Gamble, President and CEO of the Alaska Railroad Corporation, and I have with me this morning Mr. Bill O'Leary, who's the Vice President of Finance and CFO for the Alaska Railroad. Hopefully you were presented and had the opportunity through your staffs to receive a briefing that I'll speak off of this morning. If you don't have it in front of you, that's okay, because I'll use it as a guide. You also have, I believe, a work plan, which has been expressed as a series of maps which is just added information that we can talk about if necessary. And what I'd like to do is talk off this briefing and then be responsive to your questions as we go along. We are here to request legislative approval for a series of capital grant receipt revenue bonds in the aggregate not to exceed $165 million, and we're asking for the approval of the legislature to proceed with sourcing these bonds as the Alaska State Railroad Transfer statutes dictate that we should. And so we're in accordance with those appropriate statutes. What is this money for? You have a chart in front of you entitled What? It's the third page in. And since 1996, when Governor Sheffield was the president of the railroad had begun a program to rehabilitate substandard track, basically rebuild the main line of the railroad, an effort which has gone on now for 10 years, principally through annual federal appropriations coming from the FRA side, initiated by Senator Stevens. Senator Stevens began in recognition that the Alaska Railroad had not been and had deferred maintenance and had not been worked on the main line programmatically since the rebuilding after World War II in the 50s. It was time to redo the railroad. The number of derailments, the cost of those derailments attributed to main line accidents was going up. It was very expensive, but more than importantly, we were carrying more passengers, more hazardous cargo, and the risks were going up as well associated with these derailments. And so this effort began in 1996. Actually, the first construction probably started occurring about 1998. And what we're doing with this bonding request is essentially to ask for the opportunity, through a method which I will explain, to accelerate the completion of this effort that's been ongoing for 10 years and actually wrap it up. It has been our number one priority for all our capital programs since 1996, and every year we've gone to Washington and asked for money from Senator Stevens. We have reaffirmed that the money that he appropriates through the FRA to us would go into the main line. It would not go into facilities or to equipment, and that's where the money has gone. That's where this money will go as well, with some minor exceptions that we can talk about in the current year. The next chart is entitled Derailments 96 to 2005. This is just to give you an example of what has happened on the main line since we began that program. The blue line shows a nice trend down in the right direction, and those are derailments where there was damage, reportable damage, FRA reportable damage, due to derailments on the main line itself. Now, I'm not talking about derailments in the yard, but actually on the main line where you're at track speed. So that's a nice trend line. The next chart, train accident rate, goes with it, and it shows in blue the Alaska Railroad train accident rate trend as opposed to all U.S. railroads in the yellow. Once again, giving pretty strong evidence that the effort into the main line that's been ongoing is having the desired payoff, and thus sort of stimulating the idea among our staff that if we can accelerate this, we get a safer railroad faster, and I think the state and our customers would expect that from us, and thus this initiative. The next chart is called Project Information. What are we getting for our money then? We're using continuously welded rail on the Alaska Railroad now, something that 5 years ago wasn't even really discussed. It was thought that in the northern cold climates with extremes of temperature in Fairbanks, for example, 90 above and 60 below ambient, you couldn't weld rail. Well, we brought up some experienced railroaders from the Northwest U.S. that worked in Wyoming and Montana and across the passes in Washington who actually proved us quite wrong. And we have a very vigorous, continuously welded rail program ongoing in the Alaska Railroad. Now, what's the big deal? Well, the click-clack on a railroad is where the joints and the wheels push. And the exchange of energy right there is hard on the metals of both, and quite often is the single most prominent source of failures on track and damage to wheels. failure of a track at a joint is also quite often the cause of derailment because a chunk will break off and the wheel will dislodge at that point. So continuously welded rail not only gives you a smoother ride, but a much safer ride as well. In addition, we found that concrete ties serve our purposes in Alaska very well on curves. It doesn't do all that much for what we call tangent track or straight track, from you to me, for example, but on a curve where you need the stability and where the energy exchange, again, is quite high between the rail and the wheels, when you calculate the angle of a curve, you want to build that and then have it very, very stable at exactly the right degree. Concrete ties allow us to do that much better than wooden ties, and so this program would put 85,000 concrete ties on all the curves between Anchorage and Fairbanks greater than 6 degrees, again, adding quite a bit of safety and risk mitigation because, again, curves is one of the places where we have track failure. We, in addition, would get on a cycle with our wooden ties of replacing ties so that none would age more than 35 years. A tie can go to about 40 years before you start to suffer some serious breakdown, depending on how much water gets into the tie and so on. So we up that by 5 years to give ourselves a little safety margin, and then on an annual rotational basis, programmatically, we will get to a 35-year replacement cycle, which again is good and healthy, and representative of what the good railroads in the lower 48 are looking at too. All the rock ballast underneath would be granite. The river rock would be removed in the process of redoing the rail and the ties, and solid granite, which interlocks very tightly and provides a solid bed, would be a part of this effort. We have a very vigorous bridge program, and while we're doing the rail, as we reach these, and a lot of them are very small, there's about 169 bridges on the Alaska Railroad. A lot of them are very small. We would continue to do that bridge program right along with the rail as the gangs go through and upgrade those bridges as well. Just as an item of information, the last bullet talks about collision avoidance. What I've been talking about is mitigating the physical risk of track failure. Collision avoidance is a technology that we're simultaneously bringing on the Alaska Railroad that is designed to mitigate human mistakes and errors and judgment that will, in fact, complement the physical side. So in effect, we are simultaneously reducing physical risk as well as human error risk to the degree affordable and possible with the current technology. All in all, our design is to accelerate the ability to have what I would arguably say is one of the safest railroads in the United States within the next 7 or 8 years. The next chart says why. Why are we doing this? Well, I think you can tell by my advocacy that it is our number one priority still. It's a faster take than we were able to get with the current program, where each year we sort of arm wrestle over how much capital will go into the main track versus the broad program of capital improvements that we make on other areas of the railroad. So the risk reduction, the fact that we can accelerate this program by as much as 10 years, completing the work that we had intended to do between Anchorage and Fairbanks, we think is worth the premium that we would pay through the bonding. We do move a lot of passengers over that track. As you can see there on the chart, 600 passenger trains a year, 800 million gallons of hazardous materials, and we probably run the highest proportion of hazardous material cargo of any railroad that I'm aware of in the country. So anything we can do to make that effort safer, I think we owe the state. It's our obligation. There are some advantages internal to the railroad. We are much clearer than by locking these dollars in on an annual basis through bonding. We're much clearer on what's available for the rest of our capital program, as opposed to just going into each year wondering how much money we're going to get and then sorting it out late in the year before the start of the next year. The next chart is entitled, Why Now? What's happened is safety Lou. We started 5 years ago with an attempt to try to get into the federal formula funds on an annual basis instead of having to go to Senator Stevens or anyone else for appropriations and not knowing how much that appropriation would be. sometimes not being able to use that appropriation until the middle of the actual year of execution. By getting into the FTA formula funds, we are entitled on an annual basis, predictably, year to year, by law, based on a formula that looks at the number of passenger miles and the number of total miles on the railroad, and then allots to us a certain amount. And that amount grows every year slightly, about 2% a year, on out into the future. This gave us a new tool in the toolkit we've never had before. And that's the opportunity then to use that source of revenue in the entitlement to pay off the debt service. The other good thing that happened is we not only reduced the match 3 years ago from 20% to 9%, but in TILU, we increased the formula of attributable miles to the Alaska Railroad by about sixfold, from 10% attributable miles to 60% attributable miles, which means that the FTA formula dollars increased from about $5 million a year to about $30 million a year. Assuming we can make the match then, we can predictably look at that 30, 32, 34, 36 right on out into the future with a low match of only 9%. So this gave us the opportunity to consider a bonding proposal like the one that's before you. It is consistent with the corporate priority. We can do material management better because of the cost of increasing steel. We can buy in bulk and store and use it when we need it. Our passenger business is growing rapidly, and as I mentioned before, the idea that we want to make the line safer, faster, the growth in passenger service reminds us of the value that brings. We also have, at least since I've been on the railroad now for almost 5 years, had a stated priority that, you know, if and when the gas line comes, the Alaska Railroad has to be ready capacity-wise to take it on. Has to be ready in terms of the track and the bridges. It has to be ready in terms of our ability to flow it into our current customer load without cutting other customers off. And this goes a long way toward accelerating the process of being ready for the gas pipeline. And it does not impact our capital program, as I said. That remains robust. And so in the next chart, proposed financing, we're requesting up to, but not to exceed, $165 million in authorization. We would sell those bonds not all at once. We don't need the money all at once. We would, as the project goes on, we would probably have three issuances. At no time would the debt service exceed 49% of our available FTA match. So 51% of our FTA entitlements would be available to go along with the rest of our capital program. So that's quite reasonable. And then the checks and balances are still there because the ARC board will have to approve each issuance as it occurs, the specific amount, and the projects that those issuances will, in fact, buy for us. So the board is still very much involved in the process. The next chart just simply shows, as we've flowed out to 2024, what the percentage of our formula funds would be used to meet the debt service. And as you can see, we reach a peak about 2014, and then the debt starts retiring faster than it's increased until finally it zeros out. This is only one element of debt. I mean, we've had smaller borrowings that are also, you know, retired at the same time. So our debt position actually remains very healthy through this whole process. I've included a couple of GWIS charts beyond this point that go into some more detail about some of the methodology and considerations that have gone into this proposal. And I've included those and be happy to talk to those or any financial details that the committee may be interested in. But I would, at this point, stop and see if I can, along with Mr. O'Leary, respond to questions. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any questions? Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Pat, the charts and stuff are really useful, particularly to guys like me that are visually oriented. As I'm looking at the maps, do you have them?
I'm well versed with them, but go ahead, please.
All right, well, kind of hold it so you both of us can look at it. North of Mount Iska there, Wasilla, where is the Wishbone Hill where MEA is wanting to build a coal plant? Do you know
Wishbone
where it is?
Hill is not on the main line, and these charts show the main line, but Wishbone Hill, if you actually went turned off at Palmer.
Okay.
And took the Palmer cutoff instead of going straight up into Mat-Su and Wasilla. The rail bed actually ends because the track is long since gone. In fact, the river's eaten up some of the track. But if you followed that back up into the mountain there, you'd get to Wishbone Hill.
Okay. All right. So as I look at the right-hand thing that you put here, that just shows you the cumulative projects. It doesn't show you the kind of the cumulative status of the track. Is that right?
Well, that is correct, but I would say I think they're one and the same. Maybe.
Okay. All right.
I didn't explain these charts, Madam Chair, and I apologize.
That's right. And probably everybody doesn't need to know, but I'm particularly interested. So if I look at the 2015 one, the last one here, but you look at here at Hurricane. So does that legend tell me that that's welded track on wooden ties?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, and the only place that we have concrete ties then would be the kind of the yellow with orange on the side of it.
On the scale on this map, it's kind of hard to show an individual project that's small, but again, anywhere on that main line where there's a curve over 6 degrees, you're going to have concrete ties. So you'll see, for example, up north of Honolulu near Broad Pass, there's one little yellow spot up there.
Right.
That's one curve.
All right, and so then if we look down here between Potter and Bird, where there's those yellow little cross pieces in the there, does that mean that there is concrete there?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay.
There's quite a bit of curvature, as you know, along that line there.
Yes, sir. All right, I think that makes it clear. And then so the finally on the chart on 2015, where it's just a pure red line, that means that like running to Eielson or Whittier or to Eielson, it's not welded track and it's not concrete.
That's correct, because the line to Eielson, for example, carries far, far less tonnage than the main line does, and so it doesn't require the upgrade. And it was built long after the main line as well.
Sure. All right. Thank you. That's helpful. Thank you, Madam Chair.
I apologize that I forgot to explain, but the left-hand side shows the year-by-year work plan. Yep. The right-hand side is the cumulative effect that we talked about.
Yep. Thank you. Very helpful.
Other questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Gamble, if you could just tell me, if you have 80,000 joints that are in need of replacement within the next several years, how many joints do you have total? I mean, are there millions out there?
Didn't we pass a bill about that a little while ago?
I'd have to get a number for you. That's an interesting question. I mean, it's just an arithmetic. I'd have to get the calculation and run it out, and I don't have that on the tip of my brain here. But
and I guess
lots and lots, I guess, is the
answer. Continuing on to the next question, it's my understanding, and I'm not certainly a railroad person, never really been involved with them except one time, but it was my understanding that rails were made with joints to go ahead and take up the expansion and contraction, as you pointed out, alluded to earlier. And if you have a continuously welded railroad, how does it deal with those extremes of temperatures where there is expansion?
I'm not sure.
Where are these joints playing to come into play?
I think it's arguable as to whether or not it's a kind of a chicken and the egg, whether the joints were for expansion or whether the joints were a sort of a necessary evil because they couldn't make and handle sticks of rail that were any longer than the ones that they had. I mean, that length of rail, for example, that goes all the way back to the 1860s. It's just the way it is. what they discovered, and what and the reason why it took us so long, is that in fact, if you box off and create an artificial atmosphere around the weld, and create a temperature which you calculate according to the ambient variance of the area that you're talking about, for example, in Fairbanks is an extreme. It's an extreme anywhere in the United States. To go from minus 60 to 90, let's say, and you can actually calculate the expansion coefficient of the iron itself, the track, and then create an artificial temperature condition, warm that track to what you need, and then force the weld. And it's a forced weld. That's an unusual procedure. Requires a certain kind of training and a certain kind of box set that sits out over. You can, in fact, accommodate for expansion and contraction to the extent that while at the extreme ends, you need to be very vigilant and watch the track for wiggling or buckling or whatever, by and large, it'll handle it. And that's proven to be true. We've had a couple of incidents where in extremely hot weather, for several days, a piece of rail will heat soak. And it will expand, and you'll have a noticeable attempt to try to wiggle. But you know, those ties hold it into place. And if the temperature doesn't stay hot for a real long time, it'll settle back down overnight. It's when it gets heat soaked that we've had a couple of problems. But those have been really minor compared to the advantage that it's given us in terms of maintenance. Boy, the level of maintenance of welded rail is far less than it is on this. But I mean, there's a science to it. Your question is a good one, and it is a very technical question, and there's a science to doing it right. And if you don't do it right, you can screw it up real easy.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Yeah, Senator Dyson.
How many miles of track you got?
Round numbers, 500 of main line.
How long is each stick?
Well, that's interesting too, because with welded rail, you can piece up to upwards of a half a mile and then load it on a work train in one piece, and then feed it.
Wow.
As you move the train, you feed it off the back end, and then weld the two pieces, so you can actually move right along.
All right. With bolted track, how long is each piece?
80 feet.
Okay, thank you. I'll get your answer for you before we quit.
Madam Chair, I'd like to be excused from physics class.
May I go with you?
I do have a question.
Yes, go ahead.
Or just confirmation. All these bonds are for maintenance of existing track and not for expansion of new track.
That's correct.
Yeah, thank you.
And you do have a letter in your file that from Tom Dutan saying that the state it has in no way liable or can be come back to the state for these debts.
Well, and, Madam Chair, the ongoing semantic problem of mine as the railroad is an instrument of the state when railroad earnings are used to pay this, or if there should be a problem, that's really state money. It's just not general fund money.
Thank you. Senator Dyson.
Thank you. The answer is 33,000.
33,000?
Sticks.
That's joints. What I was going to say.
Did you multiply times two?
No, it's 66,000. You're right.
Oh, I meant 66.
Okay. It's a unicycle train.
Are there any other questions? Any other statements? Anything else you'd like to present to us today?
No, Madam Chair.
There's no one else online or in the room to testify. Senator Stedman, can I get your motion, please?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'd like to go ahead and make a motion that we move Senate Bill 308, Version A, from committee with individual recommendations and attached fiscal note.
No objection. Senate Bill 308 moves from committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes. Is there anything else to come before the committee today? There being none, Senate Finance is adjourned.